So I read this book called My Freshman Year, written by an anthropologist who went back and became a college freshman. She was a professor at a university and went back and became a freshman at that university for a year, incognito. And tries to explain all the wonderful behavior that we as faculty complain about all of you. And one of her big points was that you're all so busy that it's unrealistic to expect you to remember what we talked about last class. This is a very common phenomenon, apparently. And she went into this big, long explanations about why we shouldn't expect you to remember what was done in the last lecture. So I won't even ask you at the beginning of each lecture what we covered last time. But I'm not going to let you off the hook that easily, even though she has all sorts of good explanations for why you're not going to learn signals and systems this semester.
Well, at least we're honest here.
She knows that's a good idea. That sounds like interesting.
But I do, you know, I relate to your challenges with this course, but hopefully you'll have some fun this semester. So what I want to talk about today I want to introduce you essentially to some basics in communication and show you how these are enabled by some simple properties of the Fourier transform. So hopefully you'll get two things out of this lecture. You go and invest in bandwidth, because in a moment I'll explain to you why bandwidth is probably the best investment you can make. You can get, if you have billions of dollars at your disposal, to buy some of it. And bandwidth, electromagnetic spectrum. But also it'll introduce you a little bit to communications, and it'll hopefully also show you how we actually make use of things like the Fourier transform. There is a practical application at the other end of these theoretical things like Fourier transforms. And then we'll talk a little bit about modulation, demodulation. So let's first talk a little more formally about the generalized Fourier transform. A couple classes ago, we alluded to the fact that we could actually use, well, when you have a periodic signal, what's your primary way of representing that? No, just in terms of a representation. We've talked about various transforms and representations now. So when you have a periodic signal and you want to, for example, get its frequency response, what was the first technique that we introduced to do that? The first way, Fourier series, right? We said, well, Fourier series is primarily intended for periodic signals. Then we introduced the Fourier transform as a way of handling non-periodic signals. And we talked about the difference between a pulse train, which has a line spectrum, and a pulse, which has a continuous spectrum. The envelopes of those two spectrum are the same, but the one is a line spectrum and one is a continuous spectrum. So if I ask you, what is the spectrum of a pulse? You'll tell me what? Ask you to plot the magnitude of x of f as a function of f.
It's going to be
close, not quite that shape. It's a very special shape.
This is a Dirac function?
No.
It's going to be
a sine x over x function, right?
Sine function. Yes.
And if you plot the magnitude, it'll look like this.
Does it never dip below zero?
Well, this is magnitude. If I don't plot the magnitude, it goes plus and minus. But typically, when we talk about the spectrum, we talk about magnitude. Now, if on the other hand, I have a pulse train, what's the spectrum look like?
It's just a spike at whatever frequency.
Spike at the fundamental, then lower spike at the harmonic.
Right, and what about the amplitude?
Decrease.
It's exponential decay.
So describe that in terms of this picture.
Right side.
It's the tips, the top. It's just
so
the peaks.
The way these two are connected is the spectrum of this is essentially samples of this spectrum at multiples of fundamental frequency. I haven't drawn this very well, but I think you get the idea. So, continuous spectrum, line spectrum. Periodic signals have line spectra. Aperiodic signals have continuous spectra, but the neat thing is, if the shape of the two are the same, one is just a sampling of the other. Yeah.
I guess it's kind of late in the game to ask this, but like, what is the y-axis in that? Like, what is that amplitude exactly?
In this case, I'm showing Fourier transform.
Okay, but I mean, at frequency like f sub zero, that value.
It's a number.
I mean, it's
27.2.
Could you give me some units that would be, like, typically?
That would require remembering what we did two lectures ago, and I'm not supposed to ask that. No, so we wrote a function. X of omega is something like sine of k pi t1 over t or something like that. And there's some stuff in the denominator. And it's just the magnitude of this function.
So, no like watts, no amperes, no...
Well, that's a good question. So, the signal, if the signal has units of volts, this is essentially the integral of the signal multiplied by some function.
So, it would be in joules?
Well, the magnitude squared, we talked about the fact that the magnitude squared is the power spectral density. So this has units of watts per hertz. We also talked about the energy as being the integral of x of t squared. And this has units of whatever joules or your favorite units of energy are. And all of this is with respect to a mythical kind of 1-ohm resistor. That's one of the ways that we relate the power and energy equations that you see in this class to what you're used to with circuits.
What exactly is the significance of a negative frequency?
That's a good question. Let's talk about that a little bit today. That's a very common philosophical argument you, kind of, you see on the news groups all the time. Do negative frequencies really exist? Or is it a mathematical abstraction? Another version of that is, do complex signals exist in the real world? And actually, we'll talk about that today with modulation as one place where you begin to see how these two relate. But first, some more confusing math. So let's generalize Fourier transform. We have a DC or constant signal, x of t is equal to 1 from minus infinity to plus infinity. We can compute its Fourier transform, x of j omega is equal to the integral over time of 1 times e to the minus j omega t. And we talked about the fact that unfortunately this integral does not converge. So we consider an alternate approach based on an impulse function. We set delta t is equal to 0, or t not equal to 0, and the integral from minus epsilon to plus epsilon of delta lambda d lambda is equal to 1. And we show that the Fourier transform of this is equal to a constant called 1. So we then applied the duality property and showed that we can talk about the Fourier transform of this signal is equal to 2 pi delta omega, because the duality says essentially that the Fourier transform, if I take a signal and take its Fourier transform, and then I have a signal which is equal to that Fourier transform, and I take another Fourier transform, I essentially get back to the signal that I started with. So this process is known as a generalized Fourier transform, and it allows us to extend the Fourier transform to some additional musical signals, such as periodic signals. So we can write that the Fourier transform of e to the j omega 0 t is equal to 2 pi delta of omega minus omega 0. And this is what we're going to focus on today. And I'm going to show you how a large percentage of analog communications is built around this principle. So even though you might think of this as a mathematical abstraction, we can actually use this to build real communication systems.
How does the generalized Fourier transform differ from the standard Fourier transform?
Because if you take the standard Fourier transform of this signal, x of t is equal to 1, it doesn't converge.
So
but if you're willing to make this sort of theoretical modification or generalization, then we can write this, the Fourier transform of this is in fact 2 pi delta omega.
Okay, so it's really not the generalized form, it's actually a special case when x is 1. Or
the generalized Fourier transform allows us to deal with signals for which the conventional Fourier transform does not exist.
Okay.
So I don't want to belabor this too much in this course, but you are going to have Fourier transform pairs of signals for which these integrals don't actually converge. And you'll get comfortable using these, and it's just important to remember they come about from our ability to do this kind of an operation. We also showed that the Fourier transform of a periodic signal is a train of impulse functions in a line spectrum, and that's what we talked about a moment ago. So what I want to do today is show you how we put this to work. So this is hopefully will be an interesting lecture, where we can use some of these concepts. So the concept of modulation. I don't know if you remember. I know I'm probably dating myself here, but there in one of the early, I think it was the first Superman movie with Gene Hackman and Christopher Reeve. Gene Hackman has this nice little speech about real estate, and this whole plot in the movie was to basically buy up land, sink California, and then make all sorts of money because all the land on the border of California was going to become really expensive because it was now the ocean. So, you know, et cetera. But it was an interesting discussion. He also lived, as he put it, he owned the most expensive real estate in the world. He lived under like the center of Manhattan and the train station or something. And, you know, it was a dump, but it had a very expensive address. So, what do people often say about real estate? Why should you invest in real estate? In real real estate?
It only gains in value.
Why?
Usually.
There's what?
They're not making any more of it.
There's no more of it, right? There's only so much of it. Well, there's actually something more valuable than land real estate that you don't often appreciate, which is the electromagnetic spectrum. And I don't know if I may have links in the appendix, I don't remember, but if not, I'll forward you some links. What happened when I taught the course last semester, actually, this was unfolding in real time. As an example of that issue, what was one of the big things that happened last semester in terms of the electromagnetic spectrum?
The auction.
Very good. What were they auctioning off?
Something in the gigahertz range.
With some 10 gigahertz, 15 gigahertz range. And there was a battle over this. Why?
Because Google wanted it.
And anytime a big company like Google wants it, everyone gets paranoid, right? Why did Google want it?
They wanted it to be open instead of having just the standard telcos get at it. It's my understanding.
Because they wanted to build some devices which they weren't talking about, and everyone was afraid, oh, they've got something that we don't know about, and they're going to take over the world, as people usually worry about these things.
Especially
how much did that spectrum go for? Billions of dollars. Prior to that, when they auctioned off some cell phone space, it went for when they started the auction, they thought we might be lucky if it goes for $1 billion. This was maybe 3-4 years ago. Every time they do these auctions, they end up getting about either like a factor of 4 or a factor of 10 more than what they thought they were going to get for the band. So the last time they did this for some cell phone space, several telephone companies lined up and spent billions of dollars on the spectrum, much more than what they expected. Why? If you're a telephone company, if you're a cellular telephone company, why are you willing to pay billions of dollars for bandwidth? It's just in the air.
The reason you don't have cell phones is other people have to pay for service.
Because you can basically translate that bandwidth into revenue. And you can do the calculations, and when you do that, you find out even at billions of dollars per gigahertz, it's a steal.
It also kills competition, too. Because somebody else can't come up and buy up the bandwidth on either side of it and come up with a different product.
Right. So what prevents? So in the early days when, and again, I know I'm definitely dating myself here, but I used to be in an area of the city where anytime someone would drive by my house with a CB radio and I was watching Channel 2, I would get the pleasure of hearing their CB radio. That's a problem. And who prevents this problem? We'll do a little bit of political stuff today, too. So the FCC. What's the FCC's role?
To keep
the great oppressor.
What?
The great oppressor.
Make sure that speech is not free and all that.
All right. I guess you don't have too many Republicans in this room, right?
They keep the airwaves from people who would abuse them.
And right, they're basically the electromagnetic spectrum police, among other things. And they police all sorts of aspects of this, not just who has a right to use the bandwidth, but who violates the bandwidth. So when these CB radio people were, my neighbor actually got some kind of shortwave radio or something that was causing all havoc, I could call up the FCC and say, hey, this guy's violating your policies. And sure enough, eventually they sent somebody out to check it out and shut them down.
You report them, you got them shut up?
I got them shut down, yeah. Hey, Channel 2 in Chicago was a big deal. You know, the Bears games were on Channel 2. I couldn't have this. So the FCC polices all this. Electromagnetic spectrum is incredibly valuable. It's, in fact, the most expensive real estate in the world. And hence, we would like to make as efficient use of it as possible. So, what's one of the big things we were just talking about earlier in class? What's about to happen to the television spectrum?
It's probably going to get
digitized. So why are they going? So they're going digital. And what are some of the motivations for this digital? It's actually not digital. I mean, they are sending an analog signal. It just happens to carry digital information, digitally encoded television signals versus analog encoded television signals. And why are they doing this?
Is that going to take up less space in the spectrum?
It free ups bandwidth, so they can offer. So what can they do with that extra bandwidth? They can reuse it. So one of the things that's going to happen here in Mississippi, thank God, is they're going to get more TV stations, public free TV stations, at higher quality, so that they can compete somewhat with the cable companies and things. They're hoping to reuse some of the bandwidth that was you're talking about protecting the sides. They're hoping to now reuse some of that bandwidth that was reserved on the sides of the TV spectrum for other services. So they're basically going to get twice the utilization or some number like that out of this existing spectrum for analog TV. In addition to that, they're promising better reception, better quality. And I can swear to that, living out in the country, it actually is pretty cool. It's pretty good stuff. But it also has a different kind of problem than the analog transmission, if you've noticed. It drops out like a satellite signal from time to time. Versus analog, which just kind of degrades, gets noisy.
Is it taking up the same spots in the VHF and UHF spectrum, or except less bandwidth, or are they actually?
I haven't studied the allocations in detail, but they are switching all the channels around, and I understand once they throw the switch, there's going to be additional switching of the channels. But you can actually see some of them already showing up. But I think all the channel numbers are going to change once they actually make the switch. Or that was somebody who was telling me about this.
Okay, but it's still in the same general area, right?
It's still in the same general area. I don't know details of what they're doing, but they're essentially allowing stations to be closer together because there's not as much bandwidth, and the roll off is sharper, so they can pack the stations more closely.
So better.
And I don't know the details, but I'm assuming when you see things like channel 2.1, 2.2, 2.3, these are fairly close in spectrum to each other. So it's more efficient to transmit signals at higher frequencies. What this means is it takes less power for a given signal-to-noise ratio. Modulation is the process of sending multiple signals through the same medium air cables, fibers by simply shifting them to different places in the spectrum. Where you begin typically in the lab, you think about, well, I want to send a signal from this piece of equipment to this piece of equipment. Well, I'll just run a wire and connect the two of them. That was the old, you know, prehistoric times. Then somebody got this idea, well, I could send the signal through the airwaves from one system to the other, but it would be horrible if that sender monopolized the whole electromagnetic spectrum. So then someone got the brighter idea of, if I can constrain what frequencies this person uses, then I can allow other people to use the same medium to transmit signals. And that's what modulation is all about. And we do modulation everywhere, whether we're talking about fiber, whether we're talking about cable, whether we're talking about the air. Modulation is the process of essentially reusing the medium, with allowing multiple users to use the medium in different ways. And modulation is very sophisticated now, especially when you talk about things like cell phones and such. Amplitude modulation carries the information in the amplitude of the signal, and it uses typically a sinusoidal carrier. And we'll go through some of the details of this, but so in modulation, typically what we do is we take the signal, we multiply it by a sinusoid, and that shifts it up in spectrum. And we'll go through the analysis of that in a moment. With amplitude modulation, we carry the information in the amplitude of the signal. With angle modulation, we carry the information in the phase of the signal. And many other forms of modulation, including pulse amplitude modulation, where we carry the information in the amplitude of the pulses, pulse width modulation, where the information is carried in the width of the pulses, and then there's all even more sophisticated things like cone division multiplexing, spread spectrum, and other things. But these are all different ways to modulate information so that you can send multiple users can use the same bandwidth without conflicting with one another. And that's a very, it's a very big part of electrical engineering, because communications, almost every system today uses some form of communications. So let's look at amplitude modulation using a complex exponential to get some insight into how this works. So for the modulation side, we have a carrier signal. Let me go back and formally define that. So we're going to talk about an information-bearing signal, x of t, and we're going to talk about a carrier signal, cosine omega sub c of t. So we have a carrier signal, e to the j omega sub c of t, which has a carrier frequency of omega sub c. When we multiply x of t times e to the j omega c times t. So on the upper right, we start with a signal x of j omega. It's some signals has some spectrum. What is the Fourier transform of e to the j omega sub c times t? We just talked about that. We said it was 2 pi delta of omega minus omega c. Mathematically, that's what it is. Graphically, what does that mean? Well, we have delta of omega minus omega c. So how do we draw that?
It's just a spike at the fundamental frequency.
It's essentially a shift in frequency. At omega c, we have a spike. And when we write 2 pi delta of omega minus omega c, the amplitude of the spike, the weight of the spike is 2 pi. The amplitude is infinite, but the area under that signal is 2 pi. So, when we take, if you recall, and I know Tao said you all falling asleep when he was talking about Fourier transform properties, and I said, how could that be? That's like the most exciting topic I've ever seen. So, when you multiply two signals in the time domain, what happens in the frequency domain? If you get this right, then I can go tell Tao he did a good lecture. So,
Convolution,
very good. Very good. So, we multiply these two signals in the time domain, which means we convolve their spectrum. So we have x of j omega convolved with c of j omega. Well, x of j omega is this spectrum up here. C of j omega is this 2 pi delta of omega minus omega c. what happens when I convolve these two? Well, remember the sifting property.
What? Somebody said it. What?
Fourier transform.
Have not.
No.
No, this is just convolution. Just convolve these two waveforms. What's going to happen?
It's just going to shift over.
It just shifts that waveform over here. And you can prove this using the sifting property, or you can just try a few examples with Java applet, but you get the idea pretty quickly. It just shifts it over here. So, why is this useful to us from a communication standpoint?
Instead of low frequency signals, right?
What about in terms of modulation?
You can send signals at different frequencies.
Like so tell me about your car radio. You turn the dial to 99.9 or whatever, 91.1 or whatever you're... What's happening? Well, on the AM side. Let's talk about the AM side. So you turn it to 890.
You're setting it to the carrier frequency?
You're setting it to carrier frequency. When you turn that dial to 890, you're basically adjusting this carrier frequency to something. I think I don't know if it's exactly 890 kilohertz, but something like that. So when you set it to a different frequency, all you're doing is changing this. But what's happening? You're just pushing, you're able now to receive a signal which is at a different carrier frequency. Now tell me about the FCC. What does the FCC do? The FCC, and I don't have a, I think there's a link somewhere to the some information on the electromagnetic spectrum, but the FCC basically manages spectrum from 0 hertz out to infinite hertz. And there's these pictures are nice because they show you where all the signals are, all the different types of signals. But when you want to create a radio station, for example, what do?
Spend lots of money getting a broadcasting license.
You have to, and what happens in getting that broadcasting license?
You basically rent a little piece of that real estate.
You rent 99.9 kilohertz or whatever megahertz. And the FCC says, okay, you're allowed to do this, but you better not go past this frequency and this frequency because you're going to cut into the next station. And if you go past that, I'm going to sue you. And every now and then it happens that someone, either from faulty equipment or something, has had those kinds of problems. So that's this simple property of Fourier transforms actually explains how we do analog modulation, what's called AM radio or AM modulation. Amplitude modulation. Now, how do we demodulate this? Well, that's interesting. That's interesting because it's the same process again. So now we take the signal x of t, which is now this signal, the modulated signal. We multiply it by e to the j omega ct again. So we multiply it by this signal. So what happens when you convolve these two?
It shifts it back to the center frequency, zero, right?
Well, right, you're going to, and we'll show this in a moment when we talk about sines and cosines, you're going to essentially shift this signal yet again, and if we multiply by e to the j omega t when we modulate, and then we demodulate with e to the minus j omega t, this spike is going to be over here, so when we convolve this signal with this signal, it falls back to baseband. Now that's not, I'll show you this in a moment. So that's the principle of modulation and demodulation. All we have to do is the same thing for demodulation, essentially, as we do for modulation. The only key thing is that there needs to be agreement about these frequencies. So what happens is all these different radio stations set up their broadcast frequencies. All those stations are flowing in the air here, and you sit back and set your radio at 99.9 and you get the station you expect. 91.1, you get the station you expect. Because you know ahead of time who's decided what frequencies map to what radio stations. That's what your radio does.
So
now, the astute student will say, wait a second, how am I going to create this e to the j omega ct? I can't build that out of resistors and capacitors. Perhaps you can't build that out of or crystals or those kinds of things. So let's look at what happens when I actually use a sinusoid, a real signal, cosine omega sub c of t. Well, again, we have, you can hold your question for a second. If we have a signal x of j omega, what is the Fourier transform of cosine omega sub c of t? Well, now we get a pulses at omega sub c and minus omega sub c. So when we modulate this signal with these pulses, when we convolve these two, what happens? Well, we get a replica at minus omega sub c and plus omega sub c. Right? Because as you slide this thing, as you convolve these, you're going to get output here, and you're going to get output here. Now, this is not so bad because this is positive frequency and negative frequency, and we can argue sort of all day about what that means. But let's think about demodulation.
Is that what they mean by mirror frequency?
Yeah. Let's think about demodulation. What happens when I take this signal and I modulate it again? I want to demodulate it. So again, I multiply by cosine omega sub c of t. What happens when I convolve this signal with this signal? Well, let's think about that. So I'm convolving here, so I get an output here. At this point, I get two outputs here, one from each of these, and then I get an output here. So I get this signal. Now, this is a problem because there's a lot of high frequency information here. So what do I need to do to get rid of this information?
Low pass filter.
So that's essentially how amplitude modulation works. You multiply by a cosine, and then you demodulate multiplying by the same cosine. And amplitude modulation systems are really, they're fun to play with because they're so simple. You can actually build demodulators for AM signals out of a number of things. You can actually use a diode. There's all these great stories in World War II that when these things were just coming online, they used to use razor blades and buckets and all these kinds of things. And they could actually, prisoners in prison camps and things were building radios and this kind of thing. It was all pretty cool. And you can build very, very crude semiconductors. I think they even use silver or something to get like a diode type property. But you can build AM demodulators out of really simple circuits if you're willing to tolerate a little bit of noise. And that's why, you find AM radios now selling for pennies. And yeah, I mean, there have been, it's hobby enthusiasts were building all sorts of really interesting variants of these things.
So
I'm sure Dr. Lynn can explain the physics of each and every one of them.
So we low pass to get rid of the higher frequency stuff, and I guess because the other mirror image is negative frequency, we just don't worry about it.
What's well, this low pass filter wipes out both of these.
What?
But this has a frequency response from minus omega to plus omega. So it actually sits over here. So
kind of. Okay.
Now, what happens if that low pass filter is not adequately sharp? You get noise in. And this will, you will hear this as high frequency ringing. And we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get to digital signals, because we have the same kind of problem with digital signals. There's another question.
Going back to you saying that you couldn't build stuff out of resistors and stuff like that, I've always wondered, like, when a cell phone is near a really primitive amplifier or a computer monitor, how it can pick up the phone call before the phone does.
I'm guessing that's because the decompression algorithms in the phone had latency, and there's probably some synchronization that the
analog version of that doesn't. I actually wasn't aware of that.
Well, I've had my cell phone on top of a basic Class A tube amplifier, and the ring will come through the speaker before it comes through the phone.
Yeah. Well, because the ring you're hearing through the phone is digitally generated after all the signals are synced up and all that, whereas I wasn't. That's interesting because I would have thought that there's no ring tone in the signal. So,
I mean,
what I find interesting with cell phones is when you get somebody else's conversation. This happens to me quite a lot, that more than it should, I think, that you do. Anyway, so this is so there's a little bit of a problem with this, that the modulator and the demodulator have to be in phase. This otherwise you get a little bit of a phase bias. And traditionally, and these days, that's often done using a synchronization, using a phase lock loop. And we won't go into detail on that. But you can build analog AM modulation systems really, really inexpensively. But there are better ways to modulate the signal to get higher quality. So for many years, AM radio was considered fairly poor quality, and then FM radio came along and was better quality. Then, I don't know if you all remember AM stereo when that came out, and now I think there's a digital AM thing that they're also trying to do. So, you know, they're always trying to reuse bandwidth in many different ways, but amplitude modulation is the simplest. So we can derive the properties of the demodulated signal. We can take y of t and multiply it by cosine omega sub c of t, and that gives us x of t times cosine squared of omega c t, because we'd already, y of t is just x of t times cosine. So x of t then is 1 half plus 1 half cosine 2 omega sub c t. And the low-pass filter removes the cosine 2 omega sub c t version of the signal, the high-frequency replica, leaving only the baseband component. Now, suppose there's a phase difference between the transmitter and the receiver, which is very common. So now, y of t is cosine omega sub c times t plus theta. So the demodulated signal is cosine omega sub c times cosine omega sub c t plus theta. And therefore, we get the overall system, the signal that we get back is x of t times this cosine theta plus cosine 2 omega sub c times t plus theta. And this mismatch in phase simply appears as a scale factor that can be ignored. So this, if the phase difference between the transmitter and the receiver are not in sync, your car radio doesn't necessarily know what phase the radio station transmitted at. Okay. But fortunately, if it was just a fixed phase, you could ignore that. However, in the real world, the phase of the transmitter varies in some way, depending on the electronics of that system. The phase of your radio varies somehow, so you actually do get drift. You get a time-varying phase, and that starts to cause distortion, which you can hear, and that's a bad thing. So that's why you know, good receivers use phase lock loops and other things so that they can actually recover, track the stations and lock onto the frequencies. And I think you're all familiar with this, both with AM and FM modulation. Okay, so that's a little bit on amplitude modulation. Let's talk now about asynchronous demodulation. So consider the spectrum of our modulated signal. And we're going to write cosine omega sub c t plus theta as 1 half times e to the j theta, e to the j omega sub c t, plus 1 half e to the minus j theta, e to the minus j omega c t. Just using that, our basic identity that cosine x is equal to e to the jx plus e to the minus jx over 2. So we can write that, we can write the Fourier transform of that signal as the sum of two delta functions. But you'll also notice that there's a phase term, e to the j theta on the first one and e to the minus j theta on the second one. So that gives us a composite spectrum which looks something like this. And if the transmitters and receivers are exactly 90 degrees out of phase, we have problems because you start to get cosine of 90 degrees is zero. You lose your signal.
So the alternative is what's called asynchronous modulation. And this is really interesting because what you do is you include the carrier in the output, and you therefore ensure that the demodulator can sync up to the carrier and recover the original signal. Now the only price you pay for that is that you're distorting the low frequency components of your signal, because you've got to use that space in the spectrum for the carrier. And this is in fact used. This is called double sideband modulation. And it produces a signal which now not only has your information, but it also has the carrier frequency embedded in it. And that's how then at the receiver you can recover both the phase and frequency of the carrier as well as the information bearing signal. And this principle of embedding traces of the carrier in the signal, this is used repeatedly, whether we're talking about AM, FM, or even in digital transmissions, we tend to do a similar kind of thing.
They put the carrier frequency in the actual signal?
Right, so the modulated signal that we're sending, you'll notice here we have X of T, cosine as before, but we also put elements of the carrier into the signal directly. So the signal we're transmitting over the airwaves is this A plus X of T cosine omega sub C of T.
Okay, so
the spectrum looks like this.
So the time domain representation is right there.
Right.
What would just a standard AM signal look like? They always look similar to that.
You don't have this term here, so you don't have this overall modulation. You just have the X of T cosine omega zero T. So the amplitude of the signal is being is varying along with this frequency. But now you've got elements of the carrier which is giving it this envelope. So the envelope of this signal is A plus X of T. The frequency of this signal is the frequency of your carrier frequency. So you sync to the frequency and then you strip that off and you basically get the envelope.
And X of T is the carrier frequency.
X of T is your information.
It's a signal. Alright, what is A?
A is a constant. That's a modulation index that you use to control how much of the carrier you let bleed into the modulated signal.
Doesn't that technique end up costing twice as much power to transmit?
It costs some power to transmit, yeah. But it allows you asynchronous demodulation then. So the demodulator can be very simple, and here's an example of an asynchronous demodulator, diode, a resistor, and a capacitor. Because now you're simply trying to pick off the envelope of that signal. And very good, you pay a price for efficiency and more power must be used to generate this kind of a signal. But then the electronics at the other end is really simple. Now, I promised you some philosophy today. So we talked about, do negative frequencies really exist? What gets really interesting is if you think about this signal being modulated to this signal, we're wasting some information here. Why do we need both sides of these? Since that signal is an even function, we really only need half of it. So we can actually modulate that signal to look like this. And that allows us to mix in twice the number of signals in the same bandwidth. This is what's called single sideband modulation. It's slightly more complicated in hardware. So it was originally only used in applications where bandwidth was very limited. For example, transcontinental telephone lines, which were very expensive to run because they ran them under the sea in the old days when we didn't have satellites and all that. So bandwidth was very precious, so they could afford very expensive modulators and demodulators, and they actually did this to double the bandwidth of that, double the number of phone calls they could carry on those cables. This isn't used as much today in telephony, but it actually was also used in analog television signals. So for the past 20 years or so, this was primary use. This was analog TV, but of course now we're about to go digital. So the modulation scheme for digital TV is much different. But this is a nice little trick that you can essentially make use of the fact that you know that magnitude function is an even function, and you can get twice as efficient in your modulation. So this is what single sideband looks like. You take the signal x of t, you multiply it by cosine omega 0 t, omega sub c of t, and that gives us this signal. You can then filter, I don't think that picture is right, but you can essentially filter off the lower sideband or the upper sidebands and end up with this signal. So you have to use a very sharp filter here, and that's what makes this a little bit difficult, is you need a very sharp filter that just retains this chunk of the spectrum. So it's going to have a very sharp roll off here, and that's why this is a little bit more expensive in terms of filtering. Now, how do we talked about making use of this, so we can in fact do what's called frequency division multiplexing, and this is essentially how the electromagnetic spectrum works. All your radio stations transmit at different carrier frequencies. They modulate their programming at those frequencies, and then they transmit. So if you put an antenna up here and you measure everything that's coming over the airwaves, you'll see all the different radio frequencies simultaneously. And the FCC then becomes the one that manages all of this. And yes, the FCC does in fact monitor spectrum on a continuous basis in most major metropolitan areas and things like that. And you can actually see this with some of the spectrum analyzers we have up in the lab. You can hang an antenna out and connect them to spectrum analyzers, and you can look at, you can see the unmodulated spectrum, and then, and scanners and things like that also are able to do this kind of thing. But of course, knowing this, knowing this creates problems. So in the early days of cellular telephones, we had lots of engineers like you who were pretty smart, understood this, and what did they do? Well, the cell phones were built along this principle. So people bought scanners, and they could actually eavesdrop on people's telephone conversations because the information that was being transmitted here with the original analog cell phones was not encrypted. So you could drive around an area with a scanner and listen to everybody's phone calls. And amazingly, to show you how important portable communications was, people knew this and they were still willing to use cell phones because of the convenience and all that, even though they were totally unprotected. But, of course, with digital, what happened is that the actual information is an encrypted digital signal that can only be decoded knowing the encryption keys and things like that. So there's some amount of protection now with the digital system, so that even though you can demodulate the signal, the baseband signal can't really, is noise unless you know how to properly decrypt it using whatever kind of encryption standard they're using. And if those of you who go on into the computer security classes and all that, you learn about all the wonderful ways you can decrypt the digital signals. And and that kind of thing. And it happens all the time because making an analog signal totally secure is very difficult. It's very hard to mask every piece of information you need to know to decrypt that, to demodulate that signal. So usually with most modulated signals, there's some element of it that you can see and understand that's not protected. And computer security people, of course, work on this kind of thing. So this is a little bit about, this is sort of intro to communications. FM modulation is a little more complicated, but it essentially embeds information. Instead of multiplying x of t times cosine omega sub c of t with FM modulation, you actually have cosine omega sub t plus x of t. The information is actually embedded in the phase of the cosine signal. And then there's other things you can do beyond that. But so if you want to learn more about these things, you take the COM theory course. And you have both analog communications and digital communications. Okay. So did that, you had a question earlier?
Yeah, I can't.